I'm very glad to come back to Rome after 8 years. Rome has very happy connotations for me because I came here in 1980 as part of the condition for my release from prison when President Marcos finally allowed me to leave. But foolishly, I went back to the Philippines and got arrested again. And President Aquino released me last March 1986. And for that, I am grateful. Which makes it even more difficult to discuss the topic I was asked to discuss with you this morning, which is on the human rights situation and the role of the church. I'll try to be as balanced as possible, but you know that does not happen in this world. So if there are biases in my presentation, we can discuss it in the open forum. Before I proceed further, there was mentioned that there was a study day at the University of Florence, and that is really the reason why I am here in Rome. The ecumenical solidarity does not have that much money to fly over people. So we are piggybacking on the invitation at the University of Florence, where there was an interesting discussion, which is similar to most Western European countries' discussions I have visited, which is from a dictatorship to a democracy. How do you really have a transition? And where is the Philippines? Is it moving forward in the transition no matter how difficult? Has the momentum stopped? Is it sliding back? I mean, very problematic issues. Which is the context where we can discuss all the various statistics on human rights and all the controversies raging now in the Philippine church on whether human rights statistics are accurate, whether they are partisan, and things like that. So, I think for better comprehension, I'd like to briefly introduce the discussion on human rights and the church in the broader political context of the transition from the dictatorship under President Marcos to the democratic government under Mrs. Aquino. I will sketch it, then it's easier to understand it. When I was in the seminary and we had plenty of words discussing philosophy and theology, I read a review of a movie that had a quotation which I recommend to your meditation and which I am following. It said, you must confront vague ideas with clear images. Since my ideas will be somewhat vague, I'll give you some images. Because after 1986, the other slogan in the Philippines among political activists and analysts was that the situation was so complex that if you were not slightly confused, you were not thinking clearly. So, now, why is that so? Well, because if you only look at President Marcos' rule, and if you only date it to martial law, and you go to President Aquino's rule, it seems a straightforward transition. One was a dictatorship, one is a democracy. But remember that Marcos was elected in 1965. Now what was he then? I presume he was also democratic. Now, of course, there are people who say that no, Marcos was never democratic. He was a crypto-fascist all the time. And 1972 was the revelation. Is that it? Or you have a theory of conversion, that he was a democrat, but sometime in 1972, he converted to fascism. Now, of course, Mrs. Aquino, I haven't met anyone who believes she is anything but democratic. But recently, some of the military advisors have been telling her
why don't you declare a state of emergency? If she does, what does that make of her? Now, my point is, for us in the Philippines especially, politics for many years have been traditionally interpreted in very personalistic terms. No? Depends on who is the leader, if he's good, if he's bad, then things change. And what I'd like to say, in fairness, even to President Marcos, is that you cannot reduce politics to personality, no matter how dominant. And the same thing goes for Mrs. Aquino. I think she has the unenviable burden of inheriting that personalistic interpretation, so that people expect her now to change everything. And if things don't change, they blame her. In fact, in certain television programs like the BBC, you have this picture almost like Marcos was the devil and Cory is the Madonna. Although now the troubled Madonna. that was the title of a BBC documentary last month. No? So I'd like to go beyond the personalities. I mean, I cannot avoid it. I have a certain bias since he jailed me and she released me. She looks prettier to me than me. No? But I mean, I don't think it is a question that if one person is so much worse than another. They're both human beings. The problem is, what were the circumstances, what were the balance of forces within which they were to operate, and which made them decide to take certain positions? And what are these? Well, one continuity from President Marcos to Mrs. Aquino, which is the first root of the human rights problem, is that they are both the commander-in-chief of a military organization which has a continuous history and development, and which is a source of problem for democratization. You see, the armed forces of the Philippines, like any military organization, is a command organization. It could almost say, like most, well, not most, but some bishops sometimes say when the priests challenge, the church is not a democracy. And they always say, well, the military is not a democracy. The rule is obey first, ask questions later. That's very attractive to certain cardinals, no? Because in the military, if the officer says march or shoot, and you say, why, sir? They will say, civilian mentality. And yet, what is the essence of democracy? One of that is that you understand what you are trying to do instead of just following blindly. But the military is a command organization. And necessarily so, because in war, when the officer says shoot and the soldier says why, they might both be dead, no? And that is why the military have all these drills: left, right, forward, back. That is not physical drill, those are mental drills, so that when a command is given, shoot, bang, that is the military mentality. And I had many years of conversation with the military mind, so I'm starting to appreciate, again, not judging the persons, but the conditioning they have. Now, what is the conditioning of our military? Well, one, which is not, our military is very much pro-United States, no? And anti-Russian, anti-communist, and all that. That's understandable, our military was trained. Secondly, it's very anti-communist. For them, the justification for fighting is because there are communists out there. And if you are not explicitly a communist, maybe you are a crypto-communist. No?
I mean, this is a true story. It's so pathetic, except it would be funny, except it's pathetic, no? Before martial law, there were so-called radicals and moderates among the students. Then there was a demonstration of moderates, mainly students of the Catholic universities. And the military, that time the Metrocom, Metropolitan Command, came in with the riot sticks and was beating them up. And one of the soldiers said, you communist, and the boy said, I am not a communist. In fact, I am anti-communist. And the other says, never mind what kind of communist you are. and that's why when I was interrogated, the present intelligence chief, who is Colonel Quintanar, said, Ed, he says, I bring you good news. Now, finally, we have declared religious radicals as legitimate targets. Before, you have to prove that the church person is a communist before they can hit. Now, you don't have to be a communist. You just have to be a radical Christian. I said, yeah, thank you. At least we will be hit on the proper grounds. But we will still be arrested. Now, that is the kind of thinking. Now, why do I emphasize this? Well, because a president cannot run a country. A president needs a government. And a government at least has two elements. That is the civilian bureaucracy. But the more important element when it comes to problems is the military. By all political theory, Marxist or non-Marxist, this is what has the monopoly of legal violence. Everyone else is supposedly illegal unless licensed. While the military, well, it can commit mistakes, it can commit abuses, but it's legal. It can kill legally. It can exercise force legally. And so the orientation of the military is important. Now, what has happened to the Philippine military over the years is the following. One, it grew in size. I think from 48,000 when Marcos took over to 164,000 in 1977 after martial law. Now, that is the army. The regular army, air force, navy, marines, and I think the Philippine constabulary. But you have to add another 100,000 for the national police. Now the police were integrated, and the civilian home defense force, which are the paramilitary. Now we say, what's important about numbers? Well, strictly speaking, it's not yet crucial because the civilian bureaucracy has even more. It's 1.36 million, no? So you say, oh, it's bigger, the military is small. But this one is split into different ministries, local government, public school teachers, government corporations, while the military is under one command. In fact, and this might be news to you, it is only the military that has a national communications network internally. The president does not have, the ministries don't have, unless they use the media. So the advantage of the military is it has a nationwide communications network. And that is why for a while they were saying that the church was practically the only alternative national communications network. Not because the church had the walkie-talkies and radio, but because they travel a lot. They have plenty of mimeographic machines and telephones, and all, which is important because without communications, how can you rule? How can you be strong? No? That is the first important element. But the second one, which is even more important, is after martial law was declared,
the military, instead of being subordinate to the civilian authority, which is the meaning of a democracy at least, became superior to the civilian. So military, let's call it superiority. Let me explain that very briefly. You see, the military is of course hierarchical. You have an officer corps of 14,000, and then they command the others. Now the officers would be from second lieutenant, lieutenant, captain, major. After major, you are lieutenant colonel, colonel generals. In the old system, you cannot be promoted from major to lieutenant colonel unless the parliament, through its commission on appointment, approves it. So even if the president is the commander-in-chief, even if they are under generals, there was a degree of civilian control so that the military had to play politics with the politicians in order to be promoted, which made them very angry because many of the politicians were really very bad. I mean, it was unprofessional. But at the same time, curbed the military power because they could not get promoted. Because normally, the ones who command battalions, which are the combat units, are lieutenant colonels and colonels. Now, when Marcos declared martial law, parliament was abolished. And so promotion became an internal military affair. Except for the president, of course, who was the final civilian authority. Now, over the years, this developed, no? The military developed, as people say, a taste of power. Before, they used to kowtow to senators, congressmen, even governors, even mayors, because mayors had their own police. Afterwards, the military looked down on all mayors, governors, even parliament, because they were the main instrument of martial law. And it is not a simple culture of military superiority. I mean, I have understood the military a bit better, having had long conversations with them. You see, many of them afterwards developed this thinking, we are the one fighting the New People's Army. We are the one fighting the MNLF. We are the one risking our life. So, if we are the one risking our life, well, we better be the one also to hold power. Because if we cannot fight our enemies well, if our officials are corrupt or are inefficient or do not believe in development, they were thinking that way already, saying, why should we risk so much and yet not hold power? I mean, it is a fascist temptation, but you must understand how it developed. Again, it was not there from the beginning, but it developed over the years. Now, given that, I don't want to dwell too long. The problem of the new government is the following. When President Marcos was ousted in 1986, majority of the military was still with him. The total number of initial rebels were around 300 to 400 members of the so-called Reformed Armed Forces Movement. And that is out of that big number. Of course, later, people started shifting. But one of the ironies of the Aquino government is that when it came to power, the single largest portion of government was not quite under its control. And in fact, was not very convinced that the new government was going to give them a good deal. And understandably so. I mean, they cite, oh, this government might have communists, might be soft on communists. That is not the real reason. The real reason is, if you want a democracy, the military must go back to the barracks. If you want a democracy, the military must be under the civilian authorities. And the military, after 14 years, are saying, why should we? Of course, they use as the excuse the insurgency, and there is an insurgency.
But the real bottom line is, they find it very hard to accept again that the provincial commander will be under the governor, that the provincial officers will be under the congressman or the senator. That one they cannot accept. And you don't have to be ideological for that. It's a simple loss of power. And it is very hard to give up power once you have tasted it. No? I mean, just to show you that power is not simply a vague, non-material benefit. One of these consequences of power in the provinces is you control two things. One, the protection money from illegal logging, but more important, the protection money from illegal gambling. Now, in the Philippines, one of the widespread gambling is called kweteng. It's every day you buy two numbers and then they have a lottery. Brigadier General Ramos, who used to be head of Region 4 in Southern Tagalog, used to collect something like 2 million pesos a month from illegal gambling. And that is only his share. That's the general. There are other colonels, there are other majors. So there are very material benefits for holding power. Now, if they give up power, that means the congressman or the governor will now take those 2 million, which is the only way they will recover their election expenses because their salary is very small. It's 240,000 pesos a year. But one candidate last May spent 10 million pesos to run and he even lost. Now, if you win, how will you recover 10 million with a 240,000 pesos salary for 6 years? Impossible. So you get it through those. Now that is the underlying battle between military and civilian authorities in the Philippines. Again, I'm not saying that civilian authorities are necessarily always better. It's just that if you believe at all in any kind of democracy, you prefer civilian authority because at least you can fight them electorally, non-violently, compared to military authorities that are somewhat difficult to fight non-violently because they react quite violently. And it's very hard to argue when you're dead, no? Now, with this group coming, fighting Marcos, and the majority not quite convinced, one of the main dilemmas of the new government and one of the main, if not the main source of human rights problems is the unreformed Philippine military. And I really don't know how this will be done. Except, I think, and that is the saddest part, there has been some accommodation already because of real politics. Let me describe what happened. See? When Mrs. Aquino came to power, she's there, no? Legitimate, popular. And up to now, still popular. I mean, it went down a bit from very high 70 to 55%. But that is good figures anywhere, no? And no individual potential leader has the same popularity ratings. I think the highest is Salonga, 20%. So in terms of popularity and legitimacy, she is unchallenged, at this point at least. The problem is, when she came to power, what political order did she inherit? When I was released, I called it a premature baby, no? Because it had a nice head. But I said the body politic was unorganized, people power. See, people power was somewhat organized there, but the rest, they vote from time to time, a few demonstrate from time to time. But basically, people are weak, they are not organized, they are not politically conscious and active, because for many years there was censorship of media. And also, I mean, where in the world do you have people anyway who are everyday fighting in politics? They try to, but not so much the body here, which was people power, was the problem. I said that Aquino
inherited a very big right arm, the armed forces of the Philippines. And the arm was not quite following the head. It had its own motion. So much so that sometimes it was pointing the gun to the head. No? Well, of course, I belong to the resistance, and I said, it's nice for a democracy, especially if you are in Western Europe, to have a bit of a left hand. But there is no left hand in the Philippines, because the left is always cut legally. It's always illegalized. So I said, it's a very strange democracy. Nice head, weak body, big right arm. And one friend said, and I don't think that right arm was born together with that baby. It was transplanted from the old, whose head is in Hawaii. And I think that is correct. Why? Up to now, Mrs. Aquino has the Presidential Guard Battalion, which is only 300 people. As far as we know, they are loyal to her. They will defend her. President Marcos had the Presidential Security Command with 14,000 people. But after 300, what happened? Well, you take the RAM. Initially, they fought Marcos, supported Mrs. Aquino. Now, most of them are rebelling against her. In fact, the last military coup was led primarily by the officers of the Reform Armed Forces Movement. Politically, they would be more loyal to maybe Minister Enrile. And there would still be a group that is still loyal to Marcos. And as an indication, in the last elections, among the RAM, Colonel Aguinaldo in Cagayan ran for governor and won. Colonel Abadilla, who is with Marcos, ran as vice governor of Ilocos Norte and won. Now, I can imagine, no? When Jover Arroyo was still here with Mrs. Aquino, he told us a story that they had promoted 13 new generals. That was 1987. And part of the final interview was very nice, no? Because Mrs. Aquino asks strange questions, no? Not like Marcos. First of all, he asked them, do you have a second wife? it's a very moral thing. Of course, they refused to confirm or deny. But what was crucial was this. They asked the 13 generals, if there is an attempted coup, where will you sign? And you know, all said, it depends. They had just been promoted by the president. And they were saying, if there is a coup, it depends. They were not going to defend. Now, General Ramos, you know, defended the president all the time. But during the August 28 coup, which was something like 1,500 soldiers and around 300 officers, no? When they fought, General Ramos wanted to check how many would fight back. And the maximum he felt he could rely on was 8,000. Because you see, the rest of the military, they wait to see who will win. Huh? They will not actively support the coup. They will not actively fight. Now, that is more or less the balance of forces in the military now. Now, of course, you still more. The thing is, you are not sure also, because this is not loyal to her directly. They will say, it depends on our salary, on your policies. And that has been the problem and the limitations this past 2 years. I can understand that. You know, during the EDSA revolution, I was still in Fort Bonifacio. And the last 2 days, the military brought a television screen to the camp. It was a big prison for 500 prisoners. There were only three of us there, so we were then surrounded by 30 soldiers. We were all watching the EDSA revolution. And we did not know whether to feel happy that we might be released soon or feel afraid that the camp might be attacked.
and we might just die before being released. Yeah. I remember I was praying, I said, God, don't do this to me. But the soldiers behind me were saying something which reflects what I say here. You know what one soldier said? Because that was February 23, 24, 25, he says, never mind who wins, so long as it is before the end of the month, so that I know who pays my salary. Really, I mean, for him, the biggest problem is who is the government? And so, Honasan used that very effectively. He says, you must pay higher salaries to the soldiers. So everyone had to scramble to give a bigger budget to the military. Then ideologically, they say, oh, this government is soft on communism. It has communists there. And so eventually, most of the, they were not communists at all, but those who are liberal human rights lawyers were removed from government. That is the setting for the human rights problems in the Philippines. Now, it's very hard to allocate the blame, no? Because obviously you have command responsibility, a president is in charge. But at the same time, it would be unfair and incorrect to think that all these abuses, all these happenings are ordered willingly by a civilian authority. At most, they cannot stop it. Now, where does it end? You know that, well, I'm not responsible because I cannot stop. And the other is saying, well, it's a lesser evil and we will just allow it to continue. Because what happened was, at the beginning, the president put up the Presidential Commission on Human Rights to test the cases of military abuses. And the first head was Senator Jokno, who is a very credible lawyer. But I remember his big problem, no? Because it is related to my case personally. See, in 1974, when I was arrested, I was a member of the illegal resistance against Marcos. In other words, I'm not an innocent human rights victim. I was fighting, only I was not very... So, I was arrested with 30 people, 17 of whom were tortured. I was not. A few blows. It was not considered torture. So I was put before a military tribunal accused of conspiracy to commit rebellion. Now, Senator Jokno set up the free legal assistance group to defend prisoners. So he came and he says, okay, I will defend you. What did you really do? Tell your lawyer. I said, do not defend me anymore. I cannot be defended because I'm really guilty. I said, I fought Marcos. So just put me on the court and I will make, you know, a dramatic speech giving the theological grounds for resistance. And make sure you tape it so that it will be published. I mean, you know, I was thinking of a political defense, no more legal defense, because I was guilty. I mean, I fought. So he said, you might be a good theologian, but you are a lousy lawyer, na? So you be quiet. No? So he started arguing my case. And I tell you, when he started, I was sure I was guilty. When he finished, I was not very sure anymore. In fact, I was starting to be convinced I was innocent. I mean, politically guilty, but legally innocent. Why? Because he says, truth in the courts is what can be proven by legally admissible evidence. So, said, Your Honor, what is he charged of? Conspiracy. What does that mean? Are there papers captured with him? Yes. Was there a search warrant? None. Inadmissible. Okay? Were there witnesses against him? Yes. Were they taken under torture? Yes. Inadmissible. What law is he being charged under? Presidential Decree number 38. There was no copy. So we thought, maybe it's 33, illegal possession of documents. The judge said, no, it is 38.
who says, "Your Honor, give us a copy of the law so that I can defend my client." And the general, it was a military tribunal, said, "Unfortunately, we have no copy also." Because it was unpublished. It was an unpublished decree. So Jokno said, "How can we?" And yes, after three hearings, the trial stopped. So I was politically guilty, legally innocent. Now, the point of my story is the following. The military were very angry at the lawyers because they knew we were guilty, but they could not prove it legally. Now, when he became Presidential Commission on Human Rights, the detainees, the families of detainees, and he himself knew that many of the military were guilty. They could not prove it either. Because the military does not get witnesses. Come and witness while we torture. They don't do that. They blindfold you. When they shoot, obviously the witnesses are not alive to give testimony. So how do you apply standards of legal justice so that you give the soldiers due process, knowing they are guilty but having no proof? And that's why the Presidential Commission up to now has not convicted a single soldier. Now, that is one of the dilemma. And yet the soldiers are saying, "We are now being restricted by human rights." Actually, there is no way they can be restricted legally unless they make the mistake of not blindfolding people whom they torture or leaving witnesses alive. So, given that, what can we say about the ongoing human rights situation and the pros and cons? Recently in the Philippines, if you have been following the news, the anniversary of a revolution is always a time for summarizing its achievements or lack of achievements. And there were two contradictory and conflicting statements made. On the one hand, human rights organizations were saying two things: that the human rights situation is worsening, which I think is the more accurate term. But some have gone so far even and say that it is worse than under President Marcos. We will go to that later. On the other hand, some church leaders, I say leaders because there are also church here, were saying this statement is either partisan, meaning done only by opposition groups for the sake of opposing, or worse, exaggerated. I'm not sure about the exact quotation of Cardinal Sin, whether he said manufactured, but I think that's too much. I mean, I would like to believe that he was misquoted if he said manufactured, but exaggerated. No? Now, what do they mean by that, and how shall we judge it? Let us take the statistics. You see, normally human rights in law, that's a big topic now. What constitutes human rights? It's so many things, no? But the ones used by Amnesty International, various groups, is usually one: prisoners. No? Now, to call them political prisoners bring you again to another discussion on whether they are strictly political or whether they are rebels or what. But the point is, they are not ordinary criminal prisoners. They are accused of subversion, rebellion, things like that. When Mrs. Aquino came to power in 1986, I forgot the exact number of political prisoners, but one of her main promises was to release all. And she was really committed to that, so that she set up the Committee for the Immediate Release of All Political Prisoners. I remember that because I was one of the beneficiaries of that committee. It was composed of Enrile Ramos, Sagisag Arroyo, and Salonga. A picture of the Aquino government, you know. Salonga as the continuation of the old elite politicians who were against Marcos. Sagisag and Arroyo representing the new human rights lawyers who were with Aquino. and Rene and Ramos, the continuation of the old Marcos forces who underwent sudden conversion in a 3-day concilio at EDSA. That's why we call them born-again Democrats. They were fascists for 14 years, but discovered. Now, the Committee for the Immediate Release of Political Prisoners operated this way, which shows you how to judge this. The release of all political prisoners was what I would call the people's agenda. Meaning, whether you were radical, moderate, lefty, center, whatever, everyone supported the issue of release all political prisoners. It was an agenda arising from the people. But of course, the people themselves could not release the prisoners unless they would storm it like the Bastille. But that was not yet scheduled until 1996. No? Now, it became Corrie's agenda, meaning that the president personally, responding to the popular demand, and during her campaign said, if I become president, I will release all political prisoners. And she would do that, no? Except a president cannot physically release all prisoners. She has to order what? A government, so that the government will make it their agenda. And the government, while led by a president, is more than a president. And the particular government body tasked to release was this committee, which shows the composition of the Aquino government after EDSA. A bit more progressive, a bit somewhat of center, anti-Marcos, and a bit of anti-Marcos towards the end, but also anti-left, anti-communist, anti-political prisoners. Now the first day, I remember, we were already cheering, February 26. There was a mass in front of Camp Crame, and they already announced 39 prisoners will be released. And we were among the top three, the ones in that prison, Dr. Prudente, Horacio Morales, and myself. So we already had medical treatment, everyone was saying goodbye. One of the soldiers already saying, please recommend me for a job in the Middle East. They thought if you're a political prisoner being released, you will be strong with the new government, no? So we said, yeah, give us and we will recommend you. and said, please tell that the brother of this colonel in this camp is an illegal recruiter. I mean, they were already... Now, what happened was, at the end of the day, only 36 were released. Three were not. Dr. Prudente, Boy Morales, and myself. Why? Because these two were objecting. And then the other three were saying, well, let us not move too fast, because... So they were saying, we will release most. And so we were saying, this is committee for the immediate release of all. It seems they wanted committee for the eventual release of most. They were starting to modify that, no? So what happened? We told our relatives, we told the nuns of the task force detainees, the seminarians. So we mobilized the people and they went to Corrie. Corrie, you promised to release all. So Corrie called the committee. He said, I promised to release all. So Arroyo and Salonga told them, really, she promised to release all. So they said, okay, we will release them. So next day we were released, but they would still not allow the release, of course, of known communist leaders like Jose Maria Sison, Bernabe Buscaina, and all that. So it was more and more, the committee wanted only the eventual release. I remember at the beginning it was only some, then it became most, majority. But it never became the committee for the immediate release of all, because some remain. And the reason why they remain is because they are nameless and faceless. They are farmers. Secondly, technically there was a debate. They were charged with illegal possession of firearms. They could have been NPA guerrillas or murder. But you see, all the named prisoners were released, including Sison. So the image in the world is, my gosh, even the head of the Communist Party is released. Everyone must have been released. And the military were getting angry already. But I knew there were many prisoners left behind. Not that many, less than 100. And we were feeling maybe some of us should stay so that as a pressure for the release. But on the other hand, we were in prison so long already, it might change again the situation and we will not be released. So we did not have the courage to say, we will not be released unless everyone is released. And we just enjoyed our release. And some of them are still there. No name. So even for international solidarity, you know, it's easier to write for someone who is known, a priest, a writer, a lawyer. But an ordinary farmer from southern Leyte, from Davao, who's that? What's the face? What's the name? That is the first problem. Which added to the next, that some remain, and of course more are inside. Now of the new prisoners, I think we can distinguish two. There are some who are active members of the Communist Party, of the New People's Army, of the National Democratic Front, and maybe technically they are better called prisoners of war rather than political prisoners. And maybe they do belong to another category. But at the same time, there are again nameless, faceless workers, urban poor, mainly farmers. Who knows? We cannot even get the exact statistics. The figures change. Sometimes the task force is 500. I don't know. Under Marcos, annually there was an average, any given time, of around 1,000 prisoners. 1,000 annually, meaning you get arrested, some get released, others get arrested again. Under the Aquino government, I think it goes something like 500. But again, I said, only a few are known. The many are ordinary farmers. Some are accused of feeding guerrillas. Some are accused of sympathizing. And it's very hard, really, at this point, to even say how many exactly at any given time. So statistically, it's, as I said, I prefer the term worsening, because even in terms of numbers, you cannot say it's worse. And there were still more before. Except towards the end of the Marcos regime, it was becoming almost ritualized, you know. There were seasons for arresting and seasons for releasing. May 1st, because there will labor demonstrations. When we were in prison, we will prepare already the beds, because tomorrow there will be around 30 workers coming. And when you are inside, there is a perverse pleasure in receiving new prisoners, because you can get new stories. Because when you are a long-term prisoner, you say, did I tell you this story? And he says, yeah, 4 times already. But when there are new prisoners, you almost feel happy. Oh, nice. What are your stories now? No? So May 1st, June 12th, against false independence. August 21, because of the Plaza Miranda. And then later, Aquino's September 21. Those are the arrest dates. The release dates are July 2, Imelda's birthday. September 11, Marcos's birthday. Christmas, New Year. I mean, it had become almost liturgical, no? Now, it is erratic. There is no pattern. Sometimes there are many, sometimes there are none. The second, where there is an argument for worse, is that under the new government, frighteningly, there are fewer prisoners, but more dead people. What technically it's called extrajudicial execution. Well, you know the strange term that the Philippines introduced to the English language. Salvaging is meant to save, but in the Philippines it is to kill. You know. Now, this is not a straightforward a problem, no? Because there is a war in the Philippines. In other words, you cannot simply say every person killed and then attribute it to extrajudicial killing. I mean, there can be legitimate, as legitimate can be in a war, legitimate encounters where people are killed and people caught in the crossfire. When you say salvaging, you mean taking people who are not in a guerrilla unit, who are not in a fighting zone, but taking them, interrogating them, torturing, and maybe some are just killed, like some leaders of basic Christian communities. Now, the NPA admits that it also kills informers and all that. And Amnesty International and other groups would rather try to treat both as illegal and as not to be allowed, except one is a government and one is not yet a government. And so how do you apply the rules equally? So the tendency of many human rights organizations is only to have the killings attributed to government troops, and there has really been no statistical compilation of killings attributed to the guerrilla movement. But the general, this is the general pattern, is this is on the rise. Some, for example, some friends who have visited South Korea say, in South Korea, the atmosphere is so much more stifling. No? Police follow you, conversations are bugged, but there are fewer killings. They say, ironically, in the Philippines, there seems to be much more space. No? People talk freely, but also life ends very abruptly. Now, the worst part of it, and this affects me personally, is this. Well, because I am a target for that. No? I don't think I am a target to be in prison. They say I have finished my quota already. I'm not dramatizing it as if I am going to be a victim tomorrow. Nothing like that. But many friends who were fighting Marcos and who were kind of almost resigned now. Well, if I die, I die. But we're able to continue organizing, now are literally afraid. Why? Because they don't know where the danger will come from. And that is one of the particularity of the new situation. I mean, it's not as if you blame the president, you blame the armed forces, that's it. Because if you know where it's coming from, you can start preparing. But in the Philippines, you will get it from one of three sources. No? You will have the regular armed forces who might tag you as a communist, as a guerrilla, and put you in what they call their order of battle, no? OB. That one is like a martyrologium, where you, according to your prominence in the resistance, you are number one, number two, number three. In 1971, they used to have 60 names. I remember in 1974 when I was captured, they showed it to me. There are already 600 names. I presume there are already thousands here now, because technically there are 30,000 communists in the Philippines. There are around 30,000 guerrillas. So if the military knows half of them by name, they will be all in the order of battle. Now, I said that's another question altogether to be addressed, especially by centers like yours. I mean, how can you humanize war? I mean, what's that? No? But for people who are members anyway of the resistance, well, that's part of the risk they have taken. We resist, we accept the danger. But together with the AFP, within the AFP but not quite of it, you would have other units that are not commanded by the regular chain of command. For example, the whole RAM group, many of whom are still in hiding, they have their own private target. For example, when labor leader Rolando Olalio was killed, of course the immediate impulse of people is to blame the military. But deep down, they were not sure. Because it might have been military, but the ones planning a coup, who wanted to provoke unrest so that they could hit government. The same thing with Leon Alejandro. They didn't know who killed. No? And then to add to that, then you would have the vigilante. Who also do not follow even normal military investigation rules. I mean, the military rules are bad enough. These ones are worse because they don't even go through a long process of checking whether you are a member of a resistance group, a guerrilla. If they're just angry at you, they will just hit you. And technically, the military is not in charge. Now, when you are here, if you know there is only one source, after a while you start developing a defense.
But when you can be hit, while you are watching here, you might be hit here or might be hit there. That is the frightening situation. And the reason for that especially is the fighting between the armed forces and, for example, the NDF or the NPA, there is, in a sense, a certain honesty to it, meaning when you are hiding, well, you know you could get it on the other side. But here, that's the legal movement. People come, they want to form a union. The management might tell military, I think that's subversive. And immediately, the red flag is in front of the bull and says, yeah, they must be subversive. Why? They look like they're angry. You know, one military personnel who was investigating me in relation to church personnel, by the way, said, you know, intelligence starts with suspicion. That's why we can never agree with lawyers. Because lawyers will have proof beyond doubt, no, or prima facie evidence before they arrest. Intelligence says, no, if we wait until there is proof, that's too late. We have to start with suspicion. Now I said, whom do you suspect? Anyone who's trying to do good but is not getting rich. Now there is a deep wisdom in that, no? If you are trying to do good but you are not making profit, you must have political goals. And that is their thinking. So I was telling friends, you get some more money from the program and have visible consumption. Because they really, he meant that, he was not joking. He says, if you are trying to do good to poor people, but it is not in the interest of commerce or anything like that, you must have another goal. If it is not to support a government, it must be to oppose it. And unfortunately, that kind of thinking goes on, no? Now, that's why you know that the vigilantes, one of their main targets are the basic Christian communities. And you know the one who killed Fabali had this weird notion that you must be a communist. Why? Because the Pope is a communist, because he comes from Poland, which is a communist country. I mean, how can you even argue when you are dead? I mean, this I feel is the unfortunate situation. And yes, it is worse, but there are more reasons, I said, than a simple change of president or a simple complicity of some military officers. The last item that makes it worse is the fact that the other constant factor in Philippine politics, other than the military, which is the United States, is getting involved in the whole vigilante movement. No? Now, let me try to explain this very briefly. See, the United States, whether we like it or not, feel that the Philippines is part of their area for many reasons, including the fact that there are US bases there. Now, for the United States, the form of government you have, whether it's a dictatorship or a more limited democracy, is secondary. What matters is, can you keep things relatively peaceful? And more important, can you prevent the growth of the left? Because for the United States, unlike other European capitalists, the left, that cannot be in the same arena. You know, that's why many European capitalism, I don't mean socialism, capitalists feel that the American capitalists are too backward, they're not yet mature enough. Well, we Europeans, you know, we capitalists, we talk to communists and we defeat them in elections. I mean, there is that kind of thinking in Europe that the left, as left, well, there's nothing wrong with them so long as they are legal and we can defeat them in our ideas, and if they go too far, then we will have the army, you know. But since they have not yet gone too far, we do not yet use the army. But the United States, unfortunately, I do not know the reason, cannot even accept a legitimate, legal, non-violent, non-armed electoral left. Now the problem in the Philippines is, not only is there not a legal electoral left, the only left that will develop will tend to be in the popular movement, in the unions, in the cooperatives, even in some base Christian communities. Why? Because there is very little chance for elections now. There are no more elections until 1992. And so they are in non-party, non-government organizations, including the church. I mean, there is such a thing as a left in the church. Not Marxist, but yeah, various kinds of theologies of liberation, certain political options preferential for the poor, which if you break it down to, in the Philippines, poor is only poor. They said, what does that mean? No material poor. So deprived, they said, deprived meaning you have a right. Because if poor, it doesn't mean you have a right. But deprived, you have a right, but you were deprived of it. Then they added, oppressed, meaning not just deprived, even pressed down. And then others said, you're exploited, meaning you are producing, but your surplus is removed. And then they said, no, but not just exploited and saying suffering, aware that they are exploited, and therefore struggling against exploit. That's how it developed in the Philippine church. Now, I am for the PDO, the poor, deprived, and oppressed. I am for the PDOE. I am for the PDOEA. And I am for the PDOEAS. Now, when you have a preferential option for the poor, deprived, oppressed, exploited, and aware, and struggling, you are leftist. that is how it is in the Philippines. So, now, it does not take the United States to be anti-left. I mean, Filipinos have their own reason to be anti-left. But there is an added dimension when the United States gets involved. What are the added dimensions? One, it becomes very geopolitical international, no? Instead of seeing it as a quarrel within the Philippines of leftist, rightist, centrist Filipinos, they think this is part of the international communist conspiracy against capitalism. So they start looking for Russians. And any foreign missionary, it's an East German. Oh, they always say now, the NPA guerrilla accompanied by two East Europeans. They say that, no? And they could be very well be Italian. Unfortunately, there could be Italian communists also, but not just in the church, as far as I know, in the Philippines at least. I mean, so they try to make it internationalist. And therefore, the anger, instead of being localized, is part of this huge imperial anger against the monolithic communism and all that. That's one. Secondly, the cultural element. You see, Filipinos can be very violent against each other. In other words, we do not accuse foreigners of introducing violence in our ranks. But the other particularity in the Philippines is, all Filipinos after 30 minutes find out their relatives. You know that? You go to the termini on Sunday. Where are you from? You are the niece of the cousin of my second uncle. Even in prison, after we overcome the anger of the soldier against the prisoner and the prisoner against the soldier, after a while we talk. And the thinking is, well, I don't want to lose my job. If my officer orders me, I will still fight. But if we can find some way, when you are in the same culture, there are some mechanisms for dialogue, discussion, even though there is also conflict and violence. When you are from another country and you see the Philippines only as a battleground, literally you think they are statistics, bodies, peasants, and all that. Literally, the preferred American intervention is through a plane. We'll just bomb you. What are you? From a plane, there are no faces there. You just drop bombs on people, control villages, as if there were whole villages controlled. But on the ground, when you are face to face with each other, I know that, no? Both from guerrillas and from soldiers. One guerrilla was telling me, we were going to plan an ambush, and thinking of the ambush, I was thinking of the soldier who was going to pass. I had no quarrel with him personally. I mean, they start thinking that way. And some of the soldiers do that in the Philippines. So even colonels in the intelligence quarters, they are about to raid the house, they will tell the relative, please tell our cousin, she might be there. There will be selective saving. I mean, I don't want to make this too much, but I feel if it becomes very internationalized and there is a U.S. intervention in the thing, it becomes, there is no more sensitivity to other items than the politics or ideology. Which brings me to the third, then it becomes capital.